without definitively implicating Moscow. Luganov is doing his best to deceive foreign governments and the international media, but the evidence supports only one conclusion, Mr. President, the SecDef added. The Russians have launched an invasion of Ukraine, and they will likely have full control of Crimea within the next few days.
Are the Ukrainians fighting back? The president asked. The National Security Advisor took that one.
Initially and bravely, he said. But now we're seeing signs they are pulling back and regrouping.
Why?
Keep in mind that the population of Crimea is largely ethnic Russians. Many, most perhaps, would actually like to be back under the control of Moscow, not Kiev. That means they are far more loyal to Russia than to Ukraine. So we're not seeing significant resistance inside the major cities in Crimea. And with Kiev engulfed in chaos, the Ukrainian president missing, and nearly a million Ukrainians in the streets, it's not clear exactly who's calling the shots.
What's going on with Russian regular forces? The president asked. This time, it was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs who responded, speaking via a secure feed from the National Military Command Center at the Pentagon.
Sir, President Luganov has ordered some 30,000 combat troops to the Ukrainian border. We're seeing upwards of 1,000 tanks, thousands of artillery batteries and SAM batteries.
And in the air?
Russian fighter jets have been penetrating Ukrainian airspace for weeks, the SecDef reported. Today, however, oddly enough, the skies are quiet.
What do you make of that?
It seems consistent with President Luganov's deception campaign, sir. He's going to say Ukrainians loyal to Mother Russia are fighting, not regular Russian forces. He's going to say he had nothing to do with any of this. I wouldn't be surprised if he calls for a ceasefire and a snap referendum asking Crimeans if they want to be under Russian sovereignty or that of Ukraine. If that happens, believe me, anyone who voted against Moscow and for Kiev won't be long for this world.
What are our military options? The president asked.
We really don't have any, Mr. President, said the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. As you know, sir, Ukraine is not a NATO ally. We don't have a formal treaty with Kiev. Even if we were inclined to get involved, it would take us several weeks to spool up enough forces to get into the theater and retake Crimea. But that would effectively put us into a head-to-head war with Russia. That could get very ugly very fast, sir. As was just stated, Luganov has positioned some 30,000 combat troops, backed up by a whole lot of air power and heavy mechanized divisions just a few miles across the border. We'd be lucky to get 2,500 U.S. forces there within 2 weeks. It would take quite a bit longer to get any significant number of tanks and APCs on the ground. We'd be outgunned from the first shot. And keep in mind, sir, that even if we did begin to establish air dominance, and even if we were to link up with the Ukrainian ground forces and actually started to take back significant swaths of territory, and those are mighty big ifs at the moment, who is to say the Russians wouldn't escalate the situation?
How so?
It's possible Luganov could order the use of tactical battlefield nukes.
You can't be serious, said an incredulous president.
I'm afraid I am, sir. Tactical nukes are a key part of Russian military doctrine, and I don't believe we can rule out their use.
You really think Luganov wants to start a nuclear war with the United States of America? Asked the president, quickly growing angrier than Marcus had ever seen him. The chairman didn't respond. No one did. It was quiet for several moments. Marcus looked at the president, then around the room at his aides and military and foreign policy advisors at the table and on the screens. No one seemed to have a good answer to the question. And that fact was as unnerving as anything Marcus had ever heard. since joining the Secret Service.
40. The President issued a milquetoast statement. He denounced the Russian aggression and urged an immediate ceasefire and withdrawal to recognized international borders. Luganov couldn't have cared less. While not admitting that any of the little green men were active Russian forces, Luganov went on national television from the Kremlin and announced that he was fully prepared to use military force to protect all the Russian-speaking people of Ukraine, and particularly Crimea, against crimes of any kind. Within hours, the Duma, the Russian parliament, passed a resolution affirming Luganov's right and responsibility to use such force in Ukraine as he deemed necessary. Over the course of the next 48 hours, the American president took three separate calls from the leader of the Ukraine opposition, who was clearly terrified that Luganov was poised to drive all the way to Kiev. She pleaded for U.S. military assistance, arms, ammunition, communications equipment, and targeting information, as well as medical supplies and tactical air support. She expressed more distress with each successive conversation. Yet no one at Camp David or in the White House thought it wise to intervene to help the Ukrainians, lest it put Washington in a worst-case scenario showdown. "We have to be honest, Mr. President. Ukraine is squarely in the Russian sphere," the Secretary of State insisted. "They're not a member of NATO," noted the National Security Advisor. "They want it to be," the SecDef said.
"But they're not," SecState pushed back. "Look, I'm as sympathetic to their plight as anyone, but, Mr. President, we can't get into a shooting war with the Russians over Ukraine. We just can't."
She didn't need to finish the thought. Everyone knew what she meant, and everyone in the room agreed. A war with Russia, a nuclear power, could quickly get out of hand. The U.S. had already fought two major wars in Afghanistan and Iraq over the previous decade and a half, neither of which had been fully resolved, and both of which had drained trillions of dollars from the federal treasury and soured the American people on any further foreign interventions. The last thing the average American could imagine was sending soldiers or Marines to fight and die in another country to which the U.S. had no treaty obligations. In the end, the president decided to meet with Luganov face to face. Most of his advisers were dead set against the idea and said so, but the president refused to be dissuaded. He ordered preparations to be made for an emergency summit, then called the Chancellor of Germany and asked if she would host it. She immediately agreed. 3 days later, Marcus touched down in Berlin just after 6 a.m. local time. The advance team's first stop was the U.S. Embassy. They briefed the ambassador and the deputy chief of mission on the president's itinerary, secured assistance from all the relevant department heads, and met privately with the CIA station chief and legal attaché, a special agent on loan from the FBI. Next, they headed to the Hotel Adlon Kempinski, located within sight of Berlin's Brandenburg Gate, where they checked in and began working through a detailed checklist of preparations. They did a walkthrough with the hotel manager and head of security, reviewing the presidential suite and every room on three full floors that would be needed for the entire U.S. delegation. They walked through the kitchen and explained that they'd be bringing their own food, their own beverages, and their own chefs. They examined arrival points and the garage, where dozens of U.S. government vehicles would need to be parked and secured. They went up to the roof to see where the White House Communications Agency equipment would be set up, and where sharpshooters and spotters would be positioned. The following day, they met with German intelligence officials and senior representatives of the local police force to gather everything they could on current security threats and an updated list of persons of interest. They drove dozens of possible routes from the airport to the hotel, from the hotel to the U.S. Embassy, and from the hotel to the German Chancellery, where the summit would be held. They also drove routes from the hotel to three different local hospitals, and made sure each hospital was stocked with plenty of the president's blood type. Then, they used a U.S. Army helicopter to examine the motorcade routes by air, identifying possible choke points or other areas of vulnerability, and discussing ways to counter such threats. On the morning of the third day, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, the Deputy Secretary of State, and the rest of the political advance team landed in Berlin. They were greeted at the airport by the U.S. Ambassador and the DCM. Marcus and his colleagues drove them to the German Chancellery, where they met with their political and diplomatic counterparts in the German government. Finally, after a working lunch to discuss additional logistical issues, it was time for a high-stakes meeting with their counterparts from Moscow. It was precisely 5 p.m. local time when they all entered the grand conference room where the summit would be held, if it was held. The Germans and Americans entered from the left. The Russian delegation entered from the right. They convened around an enormous circular conference table. The CIA had prepared dossiers on the Russian participants, and Marcus had reviewed each one carefully prior to their departure from Washington. He knew, therefore, that the Russian advance team was headed by Alek Kraskin, President Luganov's most trusted political advisor. Alek would be negotiating the summit's itinerary, agenda, guest list, seating chart, and every other detail on behalf of the Kremlin, and would even be in charge of trying to hammer out a public statement that could be agreed upon in advance by the three world leaders and released when the summit had concluded. In this context, there was no reason for the Russian negotiator to notice, much less speak to, any member of the American security detail. But about 20 minutes into the rather heated meeting, Alek suddenly stopped himself mid-sentence and stared at Marcus so intently that everyone turned to see why. Marcus instinctively tensed. He was not used to being the center of attention. He actually had no specific protective duties in this room, and certainly no diplomatic responsibilities. He was simply there to listen to everything that was discussed, and process it from the perspective of securing the American principles when they arrived. He had no idea what to make of the fact that the head of the Russian delegation was fixated on him.
"Mr. Kraskin, is there something I can help you with?" the American ambassador finally asked, as the awkwardness of the moment threatened to derail their business.
"You,"
Alek said to Marcus, ignoring the ambassador.
"You're..."
Alek's voice trailed off. Then Alek stood, startling everyone, and began walking toward Marcus, who stood as well as the man drew closer. Marcus tried to evaluate the possible reasons for the Russian's unexpected behavior. He had no idea how he was supposed to respond. What were the rules? What was the protocol? It was unheard of for such a high-ranking Russian political official to address a member of the Secret Service, much less approach him, in a meeting like this, or at any other time. Was he about to strike him? Marcus had every right to defend himself if attacked, but he knew that any physical altercation between the two men would pour gasoline on a geopolitical fire already raging and threatening to burn out of control. Alek Kraskin stopped dead in his tracks, mere inches away from Marcus's face. For a moment, he said nothing. He just stood there, staring. There was an odd, almost quizzical look on his face. Marcus steadied his breathing, fully prepared to react, but determined not to overreact to whatever was coming. In his peripheral vision, he could see that several other officials were also now rising to their feet. The U.S. ambassador was about to speak when Alek Kraskin beat him to it.
"You're Marcus Riker, are you not?
Alec said, pointing at Marcus's chest.
Yes, sir, I am, Marcus said as politely and diplomatically as he could.
You're the agent who saved your president's life. I saw you on television. You're a hero.
Marcus said nothing, completely baffled at this point.
That's you. Am I right?
Alec pressed.
You're the one the president honored in the White House?
Yes, sir, I guess so, Marcus replied, not sure what else to add.
Well, Agent Riker, I must say, it is a pleasure to meet you,
Alec said. The Russian extended his hand. Marcus stared at it. He was tempted to look to his superiors for guidance, but felt certain this would offend the very man who could alone determine whether this summit happened or not. So he gave Alec Kraskin a firm handshake. And then, as quickly as it had begun, the moment was over. The Russian returned to his seat, and the meeting proceeded as if nothing had happened.
41. Colorado Springs, June 2017. Marcus didn't mind standing post all night in front of the presidential suite. He was just glad to be back on the front range. Andrew Clark, the newly elected president, had come to the Springs and was staying overnight at the Broadmoor Hotel and Resort, with several items on his agenda. First and foremost was visiting the headquarters of NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, once located deep inside Cheyenne Mountain, but since 2006, situated at Peterson Air Force Base. Though he'd never served in the military himself, Clark had entered office insisting he would both restore the honor of the men and women who served in the military and rebuild America's armed forces, which he said had been gutted by his loser of a predecessor. The second priority on the president's list was serving as the keynote speaker for a high-dollar fundraising dinner for Republican senatorial candidates. It was early yet. The all-important midterm elections wouldn't be held until the following year. But the president was determined to create, if at all possible, a veto-proof majority in the Senate that would enable him to pass the sweeping health care and tax reform bills he had so far been unable to get through Congress and signed into law. Both items had been checked off the list the previous day. This morning, the president was focused on the third item on his agenda, having breakfast with a dozen evangelical leaders whom he counted both key to his stunning upset victory and just as key to his re-election campaign. Marcus hadn't given any of the three a single thought. His sole interest in this trip, aside from keeping POTUS safe, was the chance to catch up with family. With the permission of the special agent in charge, Marcus had taken some personal leave and flown out to the Springs a day before the president arrived. He'd taken his mom up Pike's Peak for the day, then out for dinner at her favorite hole-in-the-wall Mexican restaurant in Monument. He'd shown her the latest pictures of Lars, who the week before had celebrated his 11th birthday, on his mobile phone, and caught her up on her grandson's latest exploits. Right on time, about halfway through dinner, Mrs. Riker made her semi-annual plea for Marcus to retire from the Secret Service, move back to Monument, and give Lars a real childhood. Marcus listened patiently and asked his mother, for the umpteenth time, if Elena was actually paying her cash to make this case every 6 months. When she denied it, like every other time, he gave her his standard reply. Thanks, Mom, but really, we're doing fine. The cruise disaster had long ago blown over. Marcus had apologized profusely. Elena had forgiven him. They'd met with Pastor Emerson for several months of counseling, and Marcus was finding ways to cut back on his hours and make a little more time for his wife and son.
When he got back to Washington on Friday night, he told his mother he was going to meet Elena and Lars for a big night he had planned for them at the Kennedy Center. And yes, he assured her, when he finally felt the time was right to retire, they would definitely come back to Colorado. The morning the president was to arrive in the Springs, Marcus had breakfast with his in-laws. He asked them to come over to the Broadmoor, so he'd be ready to meet the motorcade when it arrived just before noon, and they were more than happy to do so. They loved their son-in-law, and were as eager as ever to see the latest pictures and to hear the latest news. They just wished their daughter and only grandchild could have come, too.
"The Kennedy Center sounds exciting," Javier Garcia said, his eyes brightening when Marcus explained what he was planning. "What are you going to see?"
"Actually, it's all Lars's idea," Marcus explained. "He's been studying Moby Dick, you know, Call Me Ishmael and the like. Anyway, he's gotten kind of into the whole thing. And his teacher heard that there was going to be a performance of an opera based on the novel at the Kennedy Center. Can't say I'm a big fan of opera, but it's gotten great reviews. And you know how your daughter is determined that our son learn about more than just fly fishing and hiking 14ers.
"That's our girl," Mrs. Garcia said with a laugh.
"But in this case, it's really all Lars," Marcus said.
"What time is the show?" Mrs. Garcia asked. "You're sure you'll get back on time?"
"Oh, it won't be a problem," Marcus assured them. "The opera starts at 1900. Air Force One is wheels down at Andrews at precisely 1736. We'll chop her back to the White House. The moment we touch down, my shift will be over. My tux is hanging in my locker. I'll grab a cab and meet them there. Chick-chock, no problem." But there was a problem. The president's meeting with the evangelical leaders went long, very long. And by the time they got to the airport, Marcus knew he wasn't going to make it back to Washington on time. 42. Marcus called Elena from the tarmac.
"Don't worry, I may be a little late, but I'll make it," he insisted after explaining the situation. "I promise."
"It's okay, don't worry about it," Elena said gently.
"How about if we meet you there? I'll leave your ticket at will call."
"Thanks," Marcus said. "And honey?"
"Yes?"
"I'm sorry."
"I know," she said.
"Stay safe, and we'll see you soon."
Just then, she started a sneezing fit.
"You okay?" he asked.
"I'm fine, probably just allergies."
"You sure?"
Yeah, I'm good. "I love you, sweetheart."
"Love you too," he whispered. "Gotta go." They had come a long way. Elena had made her peace with his job and its challenges, and he was making far more of an effort to be a loving and attentive husband and father. It wasn't perfect, but it was working, and he was grateful. He hung up the phone, checked in with the SAIC, received orders to board, and bounded up the stairs and took his seat. 10 minutes later, Air Force One surged down the runway. When he heard the landing gear retract, Marcus checked his watch again. They were 47 minutes behind schedule. He knew the pilots could make up some of that time in the air. They were going east with the jet stream at their backs. Still, POTUS had nothing on his formal schedule that evening, which meant there was no particular reason the pilots needed to push. But worrying wouldn't get them there any faster.
"Stress is a choice," Marcus told himself. "Lay it down."
He tilted his seat back, closed his eyes, and uttered another prayer that the pilots would make up lost time. He didn't exactly look forward to a night of opera, but he couldn't bear the thought of missing a single moment of such a special evening with Elena and Lars. He'd missed far too much already. Lars took the news well, better than Elena had feared. After nearly a year of marriage counseling with Pastor Emerson and Maya, it was true that she had made her peace with Marcus's crazy job and crazier schedule. but Lars had not. He was struggling in school, drifting in class, underperforming on tests, and occasionally even getting into fights. The school psychologist said it was only pre-adolescence. Elena knew it was more. A boy needed the love and discipline and strong presence of his father in his life. It was no more complicated than that. But she was done being angry and worked hard to let go of her bitterness. These were the cards God had dealt them. She'd done herself and her marriage and her son no good complaining about her hand. She needed to be grateful and play them as best she could.
"Wow, you look amazing," she said as she adjusted Lars's bow tie. "Dad's going to be impressed."
"If he even shows up," the boy muttered. Elena suppressed a sigh. At least Lars wanted to spend time with his dad, she told herself. Not all 11-year-old boys did. As Lars went to grab the car keys from a dish in the kitchen, Elena gave herself one last look in the mirror. Aside from a few wrinkles around her eyes, a few extra pounds, and a single gray hair she'd found just that morning, the occupational hazards of being a mom, she'd concluded, she didn't look half bad. Her eyes were a bit red. She felt achy and a bit warm. She was afraid she was coming down with something, though she refused to let it slow her down, especially tonight. She loved the black cocktail dress and black pumps she was wearing. She loved her classic pearl necklace and earrings, the very ones she had bought herself in high school for special occasions. She was pleased that Marcus had cared enough to call her from the airport to give her an update. He hadn't always done that. But he was thinking about her, about them, and she was grateful.
"It'll only take a second, Lars," she assured him. "Don't worry, we won't be late."
After yet another sneezing fit, Elena pulled into a 7-Eleven a few blocks from their apartment to pick up some cold medicine. Lars wanted to stay in the car, but Elena insisted he come with her. It was still light out, but the corner of 8th and E Streets in the southeast section of D.C. was no place for an 11-year-old boy to be by himself on a Friday evening. Lars complained all the way into the convenience store, and then all the way up one aisle and down the other. He reminded her how heavy traffic would be, as if she hadn't ever driven in the city before. He reminded her of how hard it would be to find parking if they got to the Kennedy Center late. He couldn't argue they'd have a hard time getting decent seats, because Elena had already bought the tickets, and Lars had chosen exactly where he wanted to sit. In the center. Toward the front, of course. But he found other lines of attack, and pressed them relentlessly. Elena did her best to stay calm, if not exactly cheerful. She was feeling worse by the minute. Her eyes were watering, her head was pounding. Lars's constant grumbling about almost everything concerning life in Washington was already driving her crazy. Tonight's riff was not helping. She didn't want to lose her patience, though. The last thing she wanted was to ruin this special evening. She knew Marcus's sayings about how stress was all in her head and she could lay it down at any moment. Blah, blah, blah. Maybe that worked in the Secret Service. She hadn't exactly found it such great advice when dealing with a pre-adolescent boy, especially when Dad was on the road. Instead, she said a quick prayer, finished filling her basket, and headed toward the cashier to pay and be gone. Her heart sank when she saw five other people in line ahead of her, and it sank even further when Lars started saying she should have gone to Walgreens or CVS, which he insisted were always faster. Elena started counting silently to 50. She wasn't going to lose it. Marcus was constantly telling her to count to slow down her thoughts and steady her nerves. It was advice she never followed, but there was a first time for everything. Just then, two young men, both in their late teens, entered the store. Both were dressed in dark blue hoodies and sunglasses that obscured their faces, but to Elena they looked Hispanic. She immediately sensed something was wrong. Before she could figure out what to do, the two drew handguns and demanded that everyone stay where they were and not make any sudden moves. 43.
Fork over all the cash in the drawer, Pops,
one of them shouted at the African-American man behind the register, tossing a small duffel bag on the counter. Elena's heart was racing. She slowly reached for Lars, who just as slowly took her hand and squeezed it tightly.
Let's go, let's go, we don't got all night,
the leader demanded, waving a pistol in the face of the terrified clerk. The man's hands were trembling. He was trying to open the register, but it was taking too long.
Look at me, Pops, look at me!
The gray-haired gentleman looked up. Elena could see the fear in his eyes and knew she had the same look in her own.
Now I'm going to count to three, and when I get to three, that register better be open, or I'm going to shoot you in your brain. You got that?
The man nodded and immediately went back to work. The register finally popped open, and he began stuffing the duffel bag with cash.
Move, move, come on, let's go,
barked the leader, who then glanced back at his partner to make sure everything behind him was okay. Elena glanced at him too. The kid was standing a few feet to her left near the door. He was aiming his pistol at the line of customers, making sure none of them did anything stupid. At the same time, he was constantly looking outside at a rusty green Plymouth Duster idling out front. Elena didn't have a good view of the driver, but she could tell he too was nervous by the way he kept revving the engine every few moments, like he was trying to signal his partners that they'd already been in there way too long. She glanced at the door. It was less than 10 feet away from them, and it was unlocked. Yes, it was being guarded by the kid to her left. But would he really shoot them if they suddenly bolted out of the store to safety? These punks were thieves, but were they cold-blooded murderers? Elena doubted it. Elena knew exactly what Marcus would be doing if he were there. He'd have been armed, and she had no doubt he would have drawn down on these two and given them a single and clear ultimatum: drop their weapons or die. She also knew what he'd tell her. Do whatever these hoodlums told them. Stand still, stay calm, and don't try to be a hero. He was right, of course. It would be foolish to bolt. This would all be over in a moment. What neither Elena nor the hoodlums had accounted for was the off-duty DC cop in the restroom. Hearing all the commotion, he slowly came out of the men's room and down the aisle behind them with his service weapon drawn.
"Police! Hands up and no one dies!" he shouted.
The kid to Elena's left turned quickly to see who was behind him. The moment his gun came around, the policeman fired three shots in a row. One went wide and blew out the glass door. Another struck the boy in the chest. The third hit him in the throat. The boy flew backward through the shattered glass and landed on the pavement. The store erupted in gunfire as the leader wheeled around and began firing everything he had, and the cop returned fire. When it was all over and the smoke cleared, the driver and the second gunman were gone, and four people lay dead. The kid in the hoodie sprawled out on the pavement. The off-duty policeman, Lars, and Elena. Air Force One landed early. With the jet stream working for them, the pilots had made up the 47 minutes and more. Marcus couldn't believe his good fortune. But as the plane taxied to a stop, the special agent in charge came over to his seat and asked him if they could talk in private. "Is there a problem, sir?" Marcus asked, anxious to get moving.
"I'm afraid there is,"
the SAIC said as the rest of the detail grabbed their carry-on bags and headed off the plane. At first, Marcus thought he was being relieved of duty. He'd never seen his supervisor look so somber or hesitate to say whatever was on his mind. "Look, Marcus, there's no easy way to say this, so I'll just say it." Marcus steeled himself for whatever was coming. "There's been an incident." "What do you mean?" "A shooting at a 7-Eleven in Southeast." "And?" "Elena was there, as was Lars." Marcus froze. "But they're okay, right? Tell me they're all right." The SAIC shook his head. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm afraid they're not."
"What do you mean? What happened?"
"There was an off-duty cop in the store at the time. He drew his weapon. There was a gun battle. Elena and Lars were caught in the crossfire." Marcus heard the words, but he didn't believe them. There was no way his wife and son were at a 7-Eleven in Southeast, he explained. They were meeting him at the Kennedy Center. He needed to get there himself. He couldn't be late.
"Marcus, they're dead," the SAIC said. "Both of them. I'm so sorry."
The SAIC drove. They raced from Andrews into the city in a government sedan, lights flashing, siren blaring. Marcus couldn't hear it. All his training was failing him. He couldn't think clearly, couldn't count, couldn't focus, much less speak. This couldn't be real. It had to be a mistake. It had to be. Finally, the two men pulled up to the crime scene. A dozen police cars and several ambulances clogged the streets. A half-dozen TV news crews were covering the story live, their satellite trucks taking up nearly a city block. A D.C. detective met them and walked them over a sea of shattered glass to the blown-out front door of the convenience store. The body of the young gunman had already been removed, but his outline remained in the coagulating pool of blood.
"You sure you want to do this?" the detective asked before opening the door.
Marcus said nothing. The detective looked to the SAIC and back at Marcus, then led the two men inside. What Marcus saw was worse than anything he had let himself imagine. Three bodies, each covered in blood-drenched sheets, lay where they had fallen. Bullet casings were everywhere. An empty handbasket resting on its side immediately caught his eye. Strewn about the filthy tile, smudged with blood and dirt, were unopened packages of Dayquil and extra-strength Tylenol, a bag of Ricola, a three-pack of tissues, a Snickers, Lars's favorite, and a Dasani water bottle. Crime scene investigators were still taking photographs, still taking measurements and detailed notes. All the initial interviews with witnesses had already been conducted by the detectives, and the wounded had been taken to the hospital to be treated for shock and various minor injuries. No one was left who had actually been present when the shooting began. No one, Marcus could ask for details. It didn't matter. Marcus hadn't come to solve a crime, or even observe the aftermath of one. He had come for one simple, if unimaginable, purpose: to identify the bodies of the two people most precious to him in the world. So that's what he did. Just a few inches away, a woman's hand, cold and stiff, poked out from beneath a sheet. Marcus instantly recognized the rings. They were Elena's. He forced himself to kneel beside her body. His hands were shaking. Taking a deep breath, he slowly pulled back the sheet. There was Elena's face. Her eyes were closed. She looked like she was sleeping. She looked peaceful, so beautiful in her pearl earrings and necklace. Marcus saw blood. Then he pulled the sheet back farther and saw the damage. She'd been hit once in the chest and again in the stomach. His bottom lip quivered. He wanted to look away, but he couldn't. Marcus felt the SAIC's hand on his back, steadying him. Neither man said anything. What was there to say? Marcus leaned down and kissed Elena on her forehead, then pulled the sheet up over her face, and turned to the body next to her. Again, he slowly pulled back the sheet. Lars was lying face down. Marcus could see the holes in the back of his tux. Blood was everywhere. Slowly, carefully, he turned the boy over. His eyes were still open, and they looked so scared, haunted and alone. At this, Marcus lost it. He immediately shut Lars's eyes and cradled him in his arms and wept and wept. 44. The memorial service took place on a Thursday. It really ought to have been cold and drizzling, yet it was late June in the nation's capital, and the morning was dazzling, sunny and fresh. The skies were blue and laced with white, wispy clouds. The trees were lush and green, and every garden was in full and vibrant bloom. The humidity was surprisingly, refreshingly low, and there was a light breeze coming from the east as people entered Lincoln Park Baptist Church, just 6 blocks from the Rikers' apartment. A rather large African-American woman in her 60s knocked twice and popped her head into Carter Emerson's office. "Whenever you're ready, Pastor," she said, her eyes somber behind her glasses. "Everyone's in place." She caught Carter's eye and nodded respectfully at Marcus, then backed out of the office and closed the door. Marcus couldn't remember the woman's name. That bothered him. They had met numerous times. She was in Elena's Bible study. She'd already brought a meal to his home this week. She and her family were pillars of the congregation. Marcus's ability to observe and recall the minutest of details was something he had always prided himself on, a skill that had served him well as a criminal investigator and federal agent. Yet now even simple things were slipping from his grasp. This morning he had forgotten the PIN for his ATM card. The previous night, he'd forgotten the combination to the safe in his closet. Not that it mattered. In putting him on indefinite paid leave, his SAIC had taken away both his service weapon and his personal weapon when he'd driven him home from the 7-Eleven that terrible night. Perhaps Nick Vannetti had been right to insist on driving him to the church that morning. Nick, now deputy chief of mission in Moscow, had flown immediately to Washington when Peter Huang had called him with the news. Both men had been staying with Marcus for the past few days, making sure he was eating and that he didn't do himself any harm. Marcus kept telling them he was fine. They didn't believe him. No one did.
"Let's pray a moment before we go out," Carter said.
Nick and Peter nodded, and following the pastor's lead, bowed their heads. Marcus did not. He just stared at his hands while Emerson talked to God. Right now, Marcus was in no mood to pray. When he heard the Amen, Marcus rose and followed Carter out of the office and down the hall, with Nick and Pete tailing them. When they reached the sanctuary, Marcus was stunned. The pastor could and did draw quite an audience week after week. But Marcus had never seen the place packed to the rafters. There had to be more than 500 people crammed into the pews and portable chairs, and standing along the side and back walls, and every seat in the balcony sections was taken. It was a mixed group, racially and professionally. Most were members of the church and the community in and around Eastern Market. Still, more than 100 members of the United States Secret Service, including the director and assistant director, had come to pay their respects as well. Marcus even noticed that Senator Robert Dayton and his wife had come. Next to the senator's wife, was Annie Stewart, the aide who had survived the attack in Kandahar. The President and First Lady had, fortunately, chosen not to come, as had the Vice President and his wife. Marcus had deeply appreciated receiving handwritten notes from each of them, offering their condolences. The President's note had included a P.S., explaining that he didn't want to create a security and logistical nightmare that might shift attention off of Elena and Lars and prove distracting for Marcus's family and friends. At this, Marcus had been immensely relieved. He hadn't wanted them to come for precisely the reasons the President had mentioned, but he wouldn't have dared insult them by asking them to stay away. Marcus went to his assigned seat in the front row and hugged his mother, seated to his right. In the row behind them sat Marcus's two sisters, their husbands, and their children. To his left were the Garcias. Javier looked numb. Elena's mother and her sisters, now in their 20s, were a mess. They kept dabbing their eyes with tissues and trying to keep their mascara from streaking, but to no avail. After greeting his own family, Marcus embraced them all, holding his mother-in-law as she sobbed. When the organist played the first notes of the opening hymn, Javier finally helped her into her seat, and the service began. 45. The funeral was mercifully short, and for Marcus, most of it passed in a blur. There were hymns and scripture passages, and Carter gave a moving eulogy. Mr. Garcia spoke, choking back tears, as did one of Elena's sisters. When the choir rose to sing the final hymn, everyone in the church stood. Everyone that was, except Marcus. He just stared at the two caskets and listened to the music without hearing it. He was furious with God. How could he have allowed this to happen? He was in no mood to be spiritual. But at last, when the choir reached the final stanza, he stood, joining the rest of the congregation. He loved his wife and son, and didn't want to do anything that might dishonor their memory. When the choir was finished, the pallbearers came forward, Nick and Pete among them. Bill McDermott stepped forward as well. He'd recently been appointed by the President to serve on the National Security Council. Joining them were Marcus's SAIC and two special agents from the PPD. Together, the six men walked each casket down the center aisle, one after the other, to a black hearse waiting out front. The police escort to the cemetery was long. The burial service itself was short, for family and close friends only, as Marcus had requested. When the caskets were lowered into the ground, the group returned to the church for a reception of light snacks and soft drinks in the fellowship hall. Marcus and the families greeted all who came, chatting and reminiscing with each of them, until Pastor Emerson eventually came up, apologized for the interruption, and asked Marcus to step into his office.
"Thought you might need a break," Carter said when they were behind closed doors.
He suggested they sit a spell, then made them both some coffee from a Keurig machine behind his desk. Marcus took the mug, nodding his thanks, but didn't take a sip. He just stared into the steam.
"How you holding up?" Carter asked.
Marcus shrugged.
"Looks like you've got something on your mind, son."
That was true, but Marcus wasn't sure he wanted to say it aloud. Maybe it was better to get back to the reception. Most people had gone, but there were still some lingering. He needed to show his gratitude to everyone who had come, needed to listen to every memory about Elena and Lars they wanted to share. It wasn't perfunctory. He didn't simply feel duty-bound to be polite. Rather, he found himself deeply moved by listening to each person share memories. He wanted to reflect and remember, and it was better than him having to talk.
"They all get it," Carter said,
as if reading his mind.
They'll wait. Believe me, nobody's going nowhere.
This man was old enough to be his grandfather, Marcus thought. He needed a grandfather just then, someone older and wiser, who could show him how to function, how to put one foot in front of the other, when all he really wanted to do was hide away in his apartment and shut the whole world out. Someone who knew what he was going through. Carter Emerson had never lost a wife. He and Maya had been married almost 55 years. But their daughter, Alicia, had been murdered when she was just 17. It came up from time to time in his sermons. Carter was open about how the loss had almost caused him to walk away from Maya and the ministry. He was also a Vietnam vet, and had lost some of his closest friends in the war. Those wounds were not fresh, but they were deep. This was a man of sorrows, Marcus knew. He'd been through the valley, and come out okay.
Maybe so, Pastor, Marcus said at last. But I guarantee you there's not a soul out there who ever imagined I would outlive Elena and Lars. Not a one.
Carter sipped his coffee without comment. After a while, Marcus got up and walked over to the bookshelves. The office was lined with them, wall to wall, top to bottom. Marcus scanned the titles, the tomes of theology and eschatology, the biographies of great pastors and preachers and missionaries, the writings of the church fathers, the works on counseling and rearing children and handling finances, and choosing elders, and shepherding a congregation. Finally, Marcus turned and went to the window. He drew aside one of the white cotton curtains and looked out on the parking lot. Only a handful of cars remained. He thought again what he had thought during the service. How could God have let this happen? He was still angry, still hurting, but a new thought began to work its way around the edges of Marcus's rage, and with it came a new target for his wrath.
I've spent my whole life protecting people, Marcus said, as he stared out at a large oak tree outside the window, flush with green leaves. I've guarded generals and senators, presidents and prime ministers. I've risked my life to protect my country and our allies. But in the end, I couldn't protect the two people I love the most. What does that say about me?
Part 6. Sometime Later. 46. Nova Agaryova, Russia. June 15th.
It's time, Alex Stefanovich. We are going to war.
The president pushed back from the dining table, wiped his mouth with a white cloth napkin, tossed an unfinished piece of sausage to his black lab, Nikita, and strode straight out the French doors and across the lawn to the chopper spooling up on the helipad. Luganov had finished his morning routine, an hour in the gym, an hour in the pool, and a hearty breakfast of fresh black coffee, freshly squeezed orange juice, an omelet made of quail eggs, and a side of cottage cheese. Now Alexander Luganov had called for a meeting of his inner circle back in Moscow at precisely noon, and he was not a man willing to be late. Alek did not get up from the table immediately. He was still reeling from the astonishing plan his father-in-law had just laid out for him. Over the years, Alek had tried hard to close his eyes to the man's history of saying and doing the morally dubious. But what Luganov was describing now was downright insane. He was actually talking about invading not one, but three NATO countries, doing so simultaneously, and launching this brazen and unprovoked attack soon, within a matter of months, before Brussels, much less Washington, had a chance to know what was coming. Luganov had hinted at and alluded to such ideas before. Alek had heard him ask questions of his generals and intelligence officials that suggested he was giving some thought to such madness. But Alec had never taken any of it seriously. Until now. Alec turned and stared out the window as the president was saluted by an honor guard and boarded the helicopter. Alec berated himself for remaining silent throughout the one-sided discussion. He had not raised any objection, nor even asked a question. Yet how was he supposed to respond to such a plan? He was counselor to a man who neither sought nor brooked any counsel other than his own. Surely Petrovsky and Nimkov could see it as madness, he tried to assure himself. If anyone could wave the president off such a scheme, it would be one or both of them. Alec badly needed a cigarette, but clearly there wasn't going to be time for that. The whine of the rotors pierced the vast rooms of the mansion, and Alec knew he needed to get moving. The clearest sign that this plan was not a whim, but something Luganov was actively weighing, was the fact that he was heading back to the Kremlin to meet with his war cabinet. These days, his father-in-law seemed increasingly annoyed by any time he had to spend with his cabinet or senior staff. In recent months, he had routinely canceled meetings and asked for senior officials to route written questions through his chief of staff or through Alec himself. Alec often found himself drafting replies to this never-ending flood of queries on every manner of subject. Professionally, this made Alec a more valuable advisor than ever. He had more access to the president than almost any other human being. Strategically, however, he was worried. The president was slowly yet steadily narrowing his inner circle. He was getting input from fewer and fewer people. The Minister of Defense, Army Chief of Staff, and the head of the FSB still had a great deal of access and were summoned, or at least telephoned, more than most. Those officials who handled such mundane matters as the budget or infrastructure or education got almost no time from the president at all. As Luganov increasingly withdrew from the petty nuisance of meeting with subordinates, he spent less and less time in his office. Occasionally it was unavoidable, such as when various world leaders came to see him. Then the police would block off highways and side streets so his motorcade could whisk him to the Kremlin. Other times, like today, he would chopper in, an arrangement that allowed him to spend more and more time working out of Nova Agaryova, his immense palace west of the city, valued at over $200 million. Often his mistress stayed there as well. This made it exceedingly awkward when Luganov insisted that Alec sleep there so they could work late. Katya Slatsky was at least 35 years the president's junior. The girl was stunningly beautiful, to be sure, but she was young enough to be the man's daughter. Indeed, she was actually younger than Marina, who hated the whore who had replaced her mother with an intensity that only Alec saw. Marina had never expressed or even hinted at such feelings to her father. Whether this was out of love or fear, Alec could not say. Fortunately, Katya had not been there last night, and Luganov had been all business. The fact that the president was not only willing but eager to go back to the Kremlin meant this war plan, as dangerous as it was, had become a top priority. So Alec forced himself to his feet and headed to the chopper. And soon they were off the ground and banking eastward for the capital. When they landed inside the walls of the Kremlin, they headed straight for the conference room adjacent to Luganov's office. The war cabinet was already assembled and waiting. They all stood when the president entered the room, and sat only when he took his seat at the head of the table. In the past, Alec had sat in a chair behind the president and to the left of the chief of staff. But ever since his promotion to chief counselor, he sat at the main table with the principals, at the end directly opposite his father-in-law.
"Gentlemen, the time has come to restore the true glory of Mother Russia," Luganov began. This means bringing ethnic Russians outside our fold, back under our care, retaking lands that are rightfully ours, humiliating the West, and proving that the U.S. and NATO